May it please the Court, I am Stuart Singer. I'm counsel for the SCO Group. I will try to preserve 4 minutes for my rebuttal. And I'd like to start on the issue that, as a matter of law, the Rule 50B motion, which we brought, should have been granted. That without the Unix and the Unixware copyright, SCO cannot take action to defend the core intellectual property in the software business it acquired.
Isn't that a fact question under our prior panel opinion?
We think that there's one part which is legal and one part which is factual. The factual part is what copyrights were required. We think that was what the remand was to determine. And at the trial on that issue, there was only evidence from SCO that was unequivocal from numerous witnesses, which we cited page 33 and 34.
Was there any contrary evidence? You do that in your brief.
Yes.
And I appreciate it if you don't repeat it here. We're interested in whether there is evidence which would support the decision, not evidence that's contrary to it.
Understood, Your Honor. And the evidence which Novell relies on does not support that proposition, because there's no evidence which says either that you don't need to enforce intellectual property rights in the software business.
The question is, that begs the question of what intellectual property rights they got.
Well, to defend the source code, which unquestionably, under the included assets, all right, title, and interest in the source code for all the Unix products and the Unixware products transferred.
Except for copyrights in the first
amendment. Amended. Exactly.
Well, you've got that argument about enforcing those rights, but it's true, isn't it, that whatever added value you provided by your flavor of the Unix source code can be enforced by you totally independent of what may or may not have passed from Novell.
It is true that new work that SCO did after the transaction, they could copyright and protect that.
Right.
But they paid tens of millions of dollars for a software business which had Unix.
Well, but that brings us right back to the point that I think Judge Seymour was making. The question is, as it always has been, what passed?
But we don't think there's any question that, because it's clear in the agreement, that all right, title, and interest in...
Well, it certainly isn't all that clear in the agreement, because summary judgment was reversed.
It was reversed because we think there needed to be a determination on two issues. One, what copyrights were required. There is no evidence that these copyrights were not required, because the evidence they rely on, Mr. Tibbetts and Mr. McBride, testified they were required, except you could sell products with some type of implied license, but you couldn't defend the technology underlying those products. And with respect to the ability to make improvements, that's true, but all the core technology, Mr. Nagel, for example, testified that
How is that different from the transaction with IBM? Isn't that essentially the same thing?
Well, the transaction with
and with everybody else that
no.
the Unix who uses the Unix source code as a basis for their added value.
Absolutely different. Those were licensing agreements. They said IBM entered into a licensing agreement.
That's the question in this case. What is the legal issue? Say we have.
Well, the legal issue is Novell's argument that you should interpret amendment the APA with Amendment 2 as doing nothing more than creating a license to use.
That's the whole fact question that the panel reversed on, isn't it?
Well, we think that's...
Which is it? What does the contract mean? Was it a license or was it a copyright?
Well, this court said whatever Amendment number 2 means, it refers to the ownership of copyrights, not to licenses.
Well, it says copyrights, but it left vague. It says copyrights that are required. We don't know if anything is required.
That was de facto testimony that all of them were required, because without ownership of copyrights, you can't bring an enforcement action to protect the technology that underlies the products that you're trying to sell.
You can bring an enforcement action to protect any added value as...
But the added value doesn't go to the core intellectual property
in the business. That question goes to what you got. Did you get the copyright or did you get a license? And we said on the first appeal that issue is a fact question under this contract.
Well, even if...
Determined by the fact finder.
Even treated on the facts of that question, there's nothing in Amendment 2 that speaks about a license. If you're going to confirm a license, you would say... This is an express license. You wouldn't change the schedule of assets that are being sold.
Okay, so, before Amendment 2, the agreement and the First Amendment with the exclusion specifically said copyrights are not being transferred.
That's correct.
And then you have Amendment 2, and you had your side arguing to get Amendment 2. Well, we got copyrights. And Norvell said, no, you didn't. And they came up with this language, which was vague, which we found vague, but created a fact issue. Did copyrights transfer, or did copyrights not transfer? That is a fact question.
We think that there were two issues that were remanded on that. One was, what copyrights were required? I don't think there's any question left open in the opinion that this is an that the APA with Amendment 2 serves to transfer copyrights rather than simply to confirm a license.
So that's how you read our opinion, that really the question to be decided below is whether these were required copyrights. It's not a question that we're dealing with licenses to use in Amendment 2.
Precisely.
Okay.
Although there was a second point, which a second theory of the case, which this court said also is triable, which is that the parties intended all the copyrights to transfer, and Amendment 2 was the way they went about confirming that. So that the...
Isn't that the very fact question
that
you got summary judgment reversed?
We did, Your Honor. And on that issue, we don't argue the 50B issue, but we do argue that that is a case where the court should have granted at a minimum a new trial.
Where do we say in our opinion that as a matter of law, as a matter of unambiguous interpretation of this contract, some copyrights transferred?
I think in three places. At 578 F. 3rd, 1214, court said Amendment number 2 was
hold on. Okay.
Signed by both parties, evincing a clear intent to revise or clarify the formal schedule of copyrights transferred by Novell to Santa Cruz. Then at 1216, whatever the amendment, referring to Amendment 2, means...
Isn't Judge McConnell simply framing your argument when the language that you use, when I compared the language in your brief making this argument and compared it to the opinion, you were taking language where the author of this opinion said this is their argument and this argument makes sense, and a fact finder could agree with that argument, but a fact finder could also disagree with that argument. And the question for the fact finder is, did the original agreement intend to transfer any copyrights, or did they intend only to exclude copyrights and transfer licenses?
Well, I think that Judge McConnell's opinion goes beyond simply saying these are arguable when he says, for example, at 1216, whatever the amendment means, it refers to the ownership of copyrights, not to licenses. And Novell's entire argument at trial is that all we got was a license to use. And even the proponent of that argument, Ms. Amadia, who was the lawyer who drafted Amendment 2, admitted on cross-examination that if the copyrights were required,
right after
then they were transferred.
Right after he says the sentence that you claim is a finding as a matter of law that some copyrights transferred, he says, a rational trier of fact could surely find that Amendment number 2 clarified the original agreement so as to indicate that at least some copyrights transferred. But then he goes right on in the rest of this to say, but they could also find that they didn't. And that's a fact question.
Respectfully, I don't see anything in the opinion which says you can read this as not doing anything, as not transferring any copyrights at all, essentially being a null set. If it doesn't confirm a license, and the court said expressly that it doesn't deal with confirming a license, then the only thing that changing these schedules of assets that are transferred in a sale transaction can mean is it changes the what was sold and not sold.
But it would still open the question of whether these copyrights to the Unix technology and the UnixWare technology, whether that was required.
Yes.
Okay, and let me ask you, in order to license your flavors, the SCO group, when it develops flavors based upon the UnixWare technology, in order to license those flavors, does it have to have ownership of the copyrights?
It needs the ownership to get source code license.
And I'm not talking about ownership of the copyrights of the flavor itself. I'm talking about of the UnixWare code.
Yes, because the underlying copyrights are needed for that source code licensing because that is the core of the product which is being licensed to a third party. So it's needed for giving source code licenses to people. No one's going to go to SCO and say, I will take a source code license from you like I used to do from Unix or AT&T if you don't own the copyrights. And if there's infringement, which is what gives rise to this whole dispute, you can't sue someone from undermining that software unless you own the copyrights.
If you develop a flavor, you're saying that you are not situated to license that flavor to another party to use without owning the copyright to the source code? Why is that?
Because no one is – you might sell the products, the binary products, but to license the source code to people who want to work with it and do more –
But that's a separate issue, isn't it, from their ability to use your flavor. They could use your flavor without having and there would not be a problem with that, right?
Well, the flavor is simply built on top of the other intellectual property. It's the underlying intellectual property.
It is, but you could engage in a business in which you were selling, licensing the right to use your flavor without reference to this underlying source code, right?
That's the sale of the actual in products, which you
Correct.
Can do that, which is we've never contested that you could do that, but then you couldn't protect the value of that because someone else could come along and infringe that intellectual property and you can't do anything about it.
You couldn't protect it, but somebody could.
Well,
the owner
we
could.
The owner could, but is Novell here was not motivated to do it. The issue is the buyer couldn't protect the property that the buyer bought. If I might touch on one more issue before reserving the rest of my time.
Well, before you touch on that issue, let me ask you another one that has
yes,
sure. The rights that Novell has to the licensing fees and the rights that you are obligated to account for and pay, is that perpetual or is that temporarily limited?
Those are perpetual as long as people are using those System 5 rights and they're not terminated with a given time frame. The issue I wanted to briefly refer to is what we think was the extraordinarily prejudicial admissibility and reading to the jury of the decision by Judge Kimball that this court had reversed. It's telling the jury exactly what this court said was wrong on precisely the issue that they are to decide.
And the jury heard that it was wrong.
I'm sorry, I missed a question.
The jury heard that it was wrong, though. Judge Kimball specifically indicated that they needed to hear that, right?
Well, Judge Stewart said that this court reversed the decision, but I don't think you can unring that bell. You have a district court judge who the jury is understandably respects telling him, I viewed it this way, and then you have a line which says, well, the Court of Appeals reversed, and it's now your decision to make. And, in fact, Judge Stewart issued an order in limine earlier in the case saying this was highly prejudicial and confusing and shouldn't come in, and then without good reason reversed it.
What was the context of the reversing that decision?
Well, he reversed it on the grounds that it was relevant to our damages expert, which we respectfully submit it was not. Our damages expert did a model of what the but-for world would be without a slander of title. In that but-for world, you don't have a slander, so you don't have a litigation, and you don't have any judicial opinions at all. It was simply a basis to get this before the jury, which was greatly to our prejudice.
Copyrights are there? How many copyrights are you contesting you own and they don't?
There's roughly 20 copyrights. They are all listed, relate to the products, which are in an exhibit to the purchase agreement.
And you're claiming you own them all?
Yes. There was no distinction in the evidence with respect to that. And they include UnixWare copyrights as well.
Panel opinion. We take no position on which party ultimately owns the Unix copyrights.
And we think that's because the issue had to be tried of which copyrights were required. And there is no evidence that the copyrights were not required in order to enforce intellectual, to enforce our rights in the technology.
Which is, which is a fact question.
That is a fact question. Thank you.
Michael Jacobs, Morrison Enforcer for Novell.
You have a different view about what's required for them to enforce their rights.
We do, Your Honor. And the prior questioning elicited the distinction between the parties. It was a fact question. It was teed up to the jury amply by both sides, and the jury, after 3 weeks and a day of deliberation, found in favor of Novell. And ultimately, that's our argument to you, that this is, that these were fact questions, that SCO is vastly overreading the prior decision, the prior panel decision in this case, that the portion, Judge Seymour, that you just noted actually has an or in it. We take no position on which party ultimately owns the Unix copyrights or which copyrights were required for Santa Cruz to exercise its rights under the agreement. Another favorite snippet of SCO's is the passage where the panel opinion, the prior panel opinion says, whatever it means, it refers to ownership. Well, that prior clause is very important. Whatever it means, and the meaning of the contract, the meaning of the asset purchase agreement as amended, itself was a fact question. There is no, and SCO's record below confirms that. There was no request for an instruction to the jury on the meaning of the asset purchase agreement as amended. There was no request for a rule, there was no Rule 50 motion on that issue of the meaning of the asset purchase agreement as amended. The whole issue of interpretation of the contract was served up to the jury, and amply so.
Well, we are talking about the meaning of Amendment 2, and I don't view SCO's reading as being implausible of our decision, which, to the effect that the only fact question that was sent back was the question of what copyrights were required, not the fact that some copyrights were being transferred by virtue of Amendment 2. That doesn't seem to me to be implausible at all. And so I'm interested in your analysis of the opinion, because it seems to me that if in fact that were the case, the only thing that would have been really teed up below would be the question of what's required, right?
SCO never interpreted the prior decision in that way leading into the trial. They made no record of seeking jury instructions. They made no record of filing such a motion. But it's important to read this decision, the prior panel opinion, in context. Some of the passages that SCO is relying on, including the whatever it means it refers to passage, are in the section of the opinion that's dealing with the 204A issue. And what Judge McConnell there was analyzing was, does this agreement in some way speak enough to copyrights that we're comfortable that it's about copyrights rather than some other rights, some other intellectual property right? And so he says, at the end of the very end of this long analysis, yes, this speaks to copyrights. He says the fact that there's an exclusion that refers to copyrights, that's enough to meet the legal threshold of Section 204A. That was the core issue in the prior appeal. We were arguing that 204A set a higher standard, a not very much ambiguity standard. And what the court was saying was, no, 204A, we're satisfied. But, as the court said, there are powerful arguments in favor of Novell on the overall question of what the transaction was about. And your question about the 95% reservation is key. The basic dichotomy at trial, the basic dichotomy in the briefing, the basic dichotomy in this oral argument is, what was that transaction all about? And what the jury heard was painstaking testimony. The jury heard from the actual negotiators of the agreement itself, who represented Novell and showed the jury the interlineation of the agreement as it evolved in the very final days before closing.
True enough. And I just want to get clear your position on this. You're saying that below, as you understand it, there was no attempt by SCO to essentially say the only thing that's on the table here is the question of what's required.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly right. On the question of the meaning of Amendment Number 2, let's be clear here as well. We're talking about the meaning of the amended asset purchase agreement, not the meaning of Amendment Number 2 on a standalone basis. This is actually ordinarily an argument SCO makes, but I think they're running away from it now as they try and isolate this language. And what the jury heard about the meaning of the amended agreement from, for example, Ms. Amadia, the attorney who negotiated the amendment to the agreement, was, if I had meant to transfer ownership, I would not have merely adjusted the excluded asset schedule. I would have adjusted the included asset schedule. If I had intended to transfer ownership, I would have gotten business approval for transferring ownership. And her business contact, Mr. Tolanen, testified he never intended for there to be a transfer. Mr. Bradford, the general counsel, testified, had there been an intent to transfer, I think we would have had to go back to the board, because as the jury saw, the board minutes approving the asset purchase agreement say that Novell is reserving all of its copyrights.
But even if, would it be your position that even if one were to accept the view that Amendment 2 contemplated the transfer of some copyrights, that it did not contemplate the transfer of the Unix copyrights because they were not required?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And what underpins that? Well, you will expose some of this in questioning of Mr. Singer. As Mr. McBride admitted, both on the stand and in an SEC filing, SCO was able to carry out its business of an ordinary software company without ownership of the underlying Unix copyrights. Again, just like every other flavor vendor is able to do.
And to that point, would it be your view that SCO could actually license its flavor without owning the underlying source code? Not to its add-on addition to it, but license its flavor.
Absolutely. Just like every other flavor vendor. And there are literally hundreds, thousands of them.
Did they copyright their versions?
Did SCO file copyright registrations on their versions of UnixWare? I don't actually know the answer to that offhand.
Just curious.
Copyright adheres in, as the copyright lawyers say, copyright adheres in their work as they create it and as they publish it and distribute it.
Their added value.
Their added value, exactly. That's basic derivative work law. If you add a new chapter to a book, you and somebody else wrote the underlying book, you own the copyright in the new chapter. All of this was amply explained to the jury. The jury actually got quite an education in the way copyright law works as a result of the facts that were teed up for it below.
So how do you respond to the argument that they couldn't effectively enforce their product without owning the copyright?
Well, here again, they could enforce the rights and their added value. And one of the issues in the bench trial that Judge Kimball conducted, that this court affirmed in its prior panel opinion, was that SCO had the right to license UnixWare and sort of appurtenant thereto as a incidental act, license the underlying remaining leftover and the old versions of SVRX code. So Judge Kimball, in the prior bench decision, went through, okay, SCO has the right to license UnixWare, and now it's going to go out with this campaign to the world. And is it only about SVRX, or is it also about its UnixWare too? And he found in the bench trial, in a judgment that was affirmed, that SCO was actually more seeking to enforce its rights about UnixWare, as well as the underlying SVRX copyrights, which he had earlier held they did not own. So
what would be Novell's right to continue to receive the payments on the licensing of the basic Unix operating system if SCO owns the copyright?
Well, it's fascinating. This is exactly the point. Novell is entitled to 95% of the SVRX revenues, SCO 5%. If somebody doesn't pay their license fee, what is the remedy? SCO might have a contract remedy if it's administering the contracts, but if Novell is really the one who's going to benefit from this, Novell wants to be able to sue those breaching licensees for copyright infringement. That's the powerful remedy. And the basic architecture of the agreement, as Mr. Bram explained, as Mr. DeFazio said, I wanted to bulletproof this. This is a huge revenue stream that Novell was retaining to bridge the value gap. And so Novell wanted to retain the right, if SCO goes bankrupt, they don't want the copyrights in the bankrupt estate. And if somebody is not making their payments, since Novell has the primary interest in those payments, Novell wants to be able to retain the copyrights and go after that breaching party.
Does Section 416, does it give Novell any rights of waiver as to UnixWare products as opposed to the SVRX?
No. And this, too, is addressed in Judge Kimball's bench trial decision. SCO can go out and create its Unixware license. That's the business. Both sides agree. It acquired the right to evolve Unixware, go out and license it. There's never been any challenge from Novell. There's never been any claim that SCO has to waive any right under its Unixware licenses. All of this has been about the legacy licenses that were reserved to Novell under the basic structure of the asset purchase agreement.
Including SVRX, right?
SVRX is the heart of it,
okay.
Exactly. A few additional points. I think, as Judge Seymour, your comments indicated, there is a way to decide contract issues. The California parole evidence rule was applied by the Tenth Circuit and by this court in this prior panel decision. If evidence is inconsistent with the unambiguous meaning of the agreement, it is excluded by the parole evidence rule. SCO never sought below to exclude this ample testimony about the meaning of the asset purchase agreement, the meaning of the asset purchase agreement as amended. It never said this is inconsistent with the prior panel decision. It never said this is inconsistent with the plain meaning of the contract. And nor is it making this argument to this panel that somehow the parole evidence rule was misapplied below. This court remanded for trial the question of what the contract means and how it would be applied on these facts. And that's the trial that Judge Stewart, who assumed the case after Judge Kimball recused himself, faithfully held, giving both sides ample opportunity to protect its case.
What about the language of the asset purchase agreement that gives SCO the right to pursue legal claims? What do we do with that? Because, I mean, in the decision of the district court, all it said was it wasn't aware of any claims that were pending. That really didn't seem particularly satisfactory to me to answer the question of why that language does not give them the right to now pursue claims to protect their technology.
Well, and that
the,
is...
And the rights acquired in connection with getting Unixware technology.
So, but that lies at the heart of the issue. To say to protect their technology is a generalization. The asset purchase agreement dissects that generalization into its components. And the language... We have several arguments about this. I mean, the factual picture the jury got is that there was an asset purchase agreement that had been drafted, and then the deal team starts designing this agreement for the new structure in which Novell is going to retain 95% ownership, and this provision isn't adjusted. So hence, our first argument is this is a kind of a boilerplate, and it can't trump the very specific allocations of rights in the asset purchase agreement. If we assume it's not boilerplate, we have to credit it. All of sellers' claims arising after the closing date. And that's what Judge Stewart was pointing to. It's all of sellers' claims. Well, Novell has never said, we have some claims here that we're not transferring to SCO. SCO has, from our vantage point, our view of the record, our view of the facts, is that SCO has concocted some claims and is now trying to bootstrap on this provision. But this would have been a very different case had SCO come to Novell and said, you have some claims. We get ownership of those claims under the asset purchase agreement. That is not what SCO proved up. That was not the case they brought. They did not bring a declaratory judgment based on the existence of these claims. They brought a case based on we acquired the whole business. And that's what the jury heard the most evidence about. It also has to be read, all of seller's claims in the unamended version of the asset purchase agreement has to be read in light of the reservation of copyright ownership. They're in conflict in this sense. And so the agreement as a whole, taking these conflicting provisions, is ambiguous. It also has to be read in light of the provision of Section 4.16b that Santa Cruz, now SCO, had no right to enter into new SVRX licenses. This is key. How can you be in, claim you're in the business of enforcing these rights if you don't have the right to license? A right of ownership is a right. A right of ownership is a right to license.
And in the district court's language, then, about the unavailability of any claims or the lack of any claims being present went towards this notion that you just indicated about the fact that it was talking about sellers' claims.
Exactly.
And there were no claims that were identified.
In fact, here's the irony. When SCO amends its complaint in the district court, it sues Novell for copyright infringement. Hence, the ownership issue here affects a very claim that SCO is asserting against Novell. Well, is all of Stellar's claims mean all of Novell's claims against itself? That can't be right. And so I'm not saying the agreement is crystal clear on this by any means. I'm simply saying this was part of the gamish that the jury heard, provisions that both sides argued went this way and that way, the underlying intent of the negotiators. SCO bore the burden of proof on ownership below. If the jury came out, you know what, it's 50-50, it's a close case, we can't call it, tie goes to Novell. And that's the burden they bear in showing the kind of legal error below that would cause reversal. Last point.
You're done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May I have a minute and a half for rebuttal, Your Honor?
Nope. You got 19 seconds.
I would ask the court to look at page 1213 in the opinion where we think it's clear that the issue on remand is which copyrights were within the scope of an intended transfer. And with respect to the transfer of claims, it is all of Sellers' claims against any parties relating to any right, property, or asset included in the business. That is broad. It included the Microsoft claim that was brought right after the transfer occurred, and it includes claims against Linux, which give rise to this very dispute over copyright ownership. And that is why SCO required the copyrights in order to defend the intellectual property in Unix and Unixware, which
Thank
the
you.
Record shows continued on to the most recent versions.
Got
Thank
it.
You, Your Honors.
Thank you.